The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is Dre. And welcome to Pod Save the People. In this episode, it's me, DR, Kaya, and Miles talking about all the news that you don't know from the past week with regard to race, justice, and equity. The news that we should all be talking about. Here we go.
Kids can't vote, but there are still a lot of issues that impact them this election year. Book bans, funding for education, and whether or not their parents are complete stress cases, to name a few. Get the whole family involved in this year's elections with Crooked's Kids merchandise. I can't vote, but you can. And Read Me a Banned Book, onesies, and toddler tees will have the kids in your life dressed for progress. Shop merch for the next generation at crooked.com/store.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I am Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
I'm Mousy Johnson. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok at Feral Rapture.
I'm Kaya Henderson. You can find me on Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
And this is DeRay at DIY on Twitter.
I don't know what we came to talk about today, but I'm talking about my brother, Leonard L. Long III, who just got his master's in international business from Pepperdine University.
Come on, Leonard. Okay.
Come on, Leonard. Got to be a businessman. He a businessman now.
And I saw the program. He's only one of a handful of people who got the MBA in international
stuff. Business.
Yes.
International. But
we global, baby, global.
He better
shout
stay
out
home.
Leonard.
He better stay
of the pod,
near me for
family
time
of
being.
The pod.
Yeah. What are we going to kick off y'all with? We're going to kick off with this really insane story about the translator and the man that got the baseball player that got all this money. You know, y'all got to piece it together for me because I'm still confused about what's going on here.
Terrell, you want to hear us all? Before I give my expert sports opinion.
Yeah, before we hear from our expert.
Shohei Ohtani, who has the highest contract in American sports, his translator was stealing from him. So Ohtani doesn't speak English, so his translator does essentially all of the, or his interpreter does all of the work for him that requires him to communicate with people. And he stole $16 million. He was one of Ohtani's close friends, and he was his intermediary, not only between the sports world and reporters and stuff, but also between the banks and financial advisors in America because he didn't speak English. And he was placing bets and he was calling the bank, moving money around. Like, it just was not good. So the federal government got involved and they looked at his betting account and they found 19,000 bets between December 2021 and January 2024, a clip of nearly 25 a day. And he bet in between $10 and $160,000. And his net losses were a whopping $40 million. Importantly, he did not bet on baseball. That's like, I guess, the saving grace.
why is that important? I mean, listen, well, you losing $40 million. It don't matter what you're betting on.
I mean, I guess. But but he has a $700 million contract, Ohtani. So he is going to be okay. He can still pay for every expense that he has. And Mr. Interpreter Guy is definitely going to prison.
Yo, I don't mean to be an ugly American, but it is sort of astounding to me that a person who does not speak English has the largest sports contract in history. Like, in history, $700 million. We've never given that much money to anybody else. And this dude's interpreter is able to walk away with $40 million because the cat, like, literally, this is, I don't know. Could this happen in another country that, like, I don't speak Japanese, but I go to Japan and I'm a tennis phenom or a whatever phenom, and the whole thing just feels super weird to me. And the dude was making 25 bets a day. When did he have time to translate anything? He was busy betting. But here we are, and he's going to jail. It's kind of crazy.
I just don't understand. You get that kind of money, don't they give you a fight? Don't they give you some help around it? It's just like...
He's the help.
He was the help.
He's the help.
But he's a translator. He's not like a wealth management advisor.
When the only person who you can communicate with is this dude.
This man, this baseball player don't have any cousins or something. What is going on? You know, if one of us had that kind of money, the house would be full of people. Talking about, what's that translator saying?
I don't agree with that. I do not agree with that. I was mysteriously just always be at a beach.
You'd be called the translator, be like, where is my...
Don't ask me for nothing. Don't tell nobody.
Meanwhile, while you are on the beach, we're about to go into World War III. I mean, no, you know, don't be alarmed. But Iran fired on Israel, over 300 drones and whatnot. The United States, who right now is supposed to be trying to, you know, yank Israel up by the collar, was like, oh yeah, we'll come to your aid, and shot down the drones, and are now saying, yeah, that's it, it's done. But I'm sorry, I don't think that that's how war works, right? You fire on me, I just chill. What do we think is going to happen?
This is so scary. I don't even know. I don't, like, intellectually, like, before I could even wrap my mind around it, my body's just, I don't know.
You know, I think that they thought nobody knows where Palestine is. Nobody is going to pay attention when it first started. And I think that they were wholly unprepared for the backlash around what has happened in the West Bank and Gaza. So that is like one thing.
When you say they, you mean Israel?
No, I think the American politicians. I think the American politicians were like, nobody knows where Palestine is. Just
this,
like,
is,
if you ask people
something.
Yeah, like, where is Iraq? Still today, you ask people to point to Iraq on a map, don't nobody know, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that with everything that happened with Iraq, you know, people were the activists were upset about it, but I think it would be untrue to say the country was upset about a lot of that stuff until a little bit later. But they just overplayed. Like, I think that they were just unprepared for this backlash. So Israel is like, you know, it's, at first it was like, how dare you say they bomb a hospital? Then it's like, they bombed a lot of hospitals. They done killed Chef Jose's food people. They done killed.
And a lot of other people besides them. Those are just
a lot of other people.
They've
killed the UN people. It has been so wild to see. And then they go and destroy one of the embassies. And you're like, it really is like, at what point?
Right. What did you think was going to happen?
And yeah, somebody is going to respond at some point. Mm-hmm. Like, that is just the, not everybody's going to be afraid of America forever. And that is sort of what happened. And it's interesting even to see people try to contort themselves to defend Israel. And it's like, I'm not even saying, you know, we need to live in a world without war, because let's be clear, all the people who die in these wars are not the people who made the decisions that are causing, it's regular people who are dying. So, like, I'm team no war, if not only because the people who actually engaged in conflict are not the ones who put their lives on the line. But at a point, it's like, Israel is just operating with impunity here, and somebody will respond.
Because what's been happening online, Ugh, y'all really just, everybody needs to find some type of convening space to go to actually speak in person, because the online stuff is driving me crazy. But what I've been seeing is that it's perceived by Jewish people that everyone now is saying, yay, go Iran. You are coming to the aid of Gaza. We all know Iran and what Iran has been doing in terms of raping and pillaging and like really moving with real impunity for a very long time. And there's been a whole movement led by primarily by women to try to get as much exposure and visibility on what's going on in Iran, because it is nutso. So I think it's another one of those cases where a bunch of things can be true at the same time, right? Like Israel needs to stop. But, you know, Israel was going to start a ground offensive this week in Rafah. Now that has been postponed, the latest I read. But it's like you bomb the place to smithereens and then you have a ground offensive. What are we doing here? What's happening? So it's just, it's an interesting thing that obviously that we will continue to keep an eye on, but it's just the politics and the perceptions and the narratives around what's happening in this part of the world are so filled with feeling and sentiment and trauma that I think oftentimes it's hard to have like a constructive and practical conversation around what we need to be raising up in the region.
Yeah, I just wish, and I know you, like when it comes to politics, wishing is kind of like naive and immature. I just wish the ceasefire requests were taken more seriously when they were happening. I wish that when people were saying things around defense of Palestinians, that was actually listened to. And now we're in a position that's even scarier than before, you know, and that's just even more electric than before, and which is just really, really scary. And I think, you know, my first mind is I want to see us get through this, but I hope that in the future, me being optimistic, seeing the future, but in the future, I hope that people, specifically politicians, take seriously global politics. Like, we're in a totally new era, to DeRay's point. We're in an era where everybody can see everything. If somebody has a niche or segmented interest or what's going on in politics, they can communicate that on the internet and let other people know who don't know about it. People are able to be activated. So this kind of era of like sneaky behind your back politics of doing stuff is just going, it's just totally done for. And I think that when people were calling for ceasefires, it was just seen as like, oh, these group of, you know, anti-Zionist people calling for a ceasefire. But it seems like now it's going to prove itself to be even more beneficial. Like, it's not, the ceasefire was for, in a lot of people's minds, just about helping and saving the Palestinian people from this genocide. And now it's going to show that there was even more reasons politically that the ceasefire could have really benefited everybody involved globally, you know?
Well, and I mean, if you've been following global politics, Iran has nuclear weapons. Iran has increasingly built their capacity in the last few years to amass and retain nuclear arms. And so this is not just a little, like we started with the drones, but we have no idea what the real impact of this war could be if Iran goes full throttle. And I think, you know, DeRay, you were talking earlier about how people don't know where things are on the map. And I think the reason why there has been a unified response to Israel is that it sits in the middle of an Arab world. And we can't, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? It's what the law of gravity or some physics thing that I don't know about says. And so I think it is naive of us to think that people can act without others responding and bringing to bear whatever capacity they have. And so for me, this is really, really scary, because Israel acted, bombed the Iranian embassy. Iran responded and sent over 300 drones. And the U.S. knocked those drones down and averted potential disaster. But I find it really hard to see how this does not escalate into not just a regional war, but other people are going to pop in and say, well, wait a minute, if you're on Israel's side, I'm on Iran's side. And I'm super worried that we are not inching. We're probably barreling towards what might be our next, international conflict. I mean, it really does feel like we're living in the last days. We have global war. We have the earth is angry. the nations are angry. Like eclipses, Mercury in retrograde.
Hold on.
Come on, help me, nephew.
There's been a lot of collapsing. Solar eclipses are something that's been happening.
Phenomenon.
Yes,
Thank you.
Mercury retrogrades all the time. So those are one thing too. And I hear you. And I think I've been really big on, and this is almost like anti being on this podcast sometimes, I've been really big on not being on social media this year. It's just and trying to get my news sources from somewhere more contained, but then also just trying to not be in so much commentary. And I guess this ties in, but speaking of shout outs, I went to Montclair University and the students were amazing. There was no students there who were over 19. And they were talking so brilliantly about what was going on across the world, about what was going on in Palestine, what goes on with gender. We just had such a big conversation about everything. And I don't know. I think the world and the earth does have these moments of renewal and does have these death and rebirth processes. And I think that if I were a betting person, I would say that every generation gets to answer how peaceful can we make this? What is love? What can we do next? And I think this is our generation's time to really say we don't stand for this. I think that we do stand for this, and I don't think that I don't see the end times. I see a beginning of new times, but I think that we're in these. I think we're in a moment where it's like, are we going to repeat history? You know, and now the history that we've repeated is accessible, and we can see it. And I'm not saying it's not scary. I'm not saying that everything is gonna go well, and I'm not just having my head in the sand. But I do think specifically during specific dark times like this, it's so important to have a politic of some type of optimism and of some type of like hope and love politic when it comes to this, because that's really all you have. And not love in a floaty, fluffy way, but love when it comes to, oh, we need to show that there's people here who are for peace, people who are here for love, people who are here for a global world where everybody can be safe. And I do think when you look at history, every generation gets asked, what do you stand for and what are you falling for? And I think this is our moment.
I love that. That is so, thank you for offering that to the space. It's true that these days, the only thing that gives me hope are young people, because young people have a very clear idea about the world they want to live in, and this is not it. And they know how to pursue justice, and they know how to pursue political change. And so thank you for reminding me that even when all looks dim and the old people have messed it all up, that there are still forces for good in the world, and they are active and engaged. And amen. Hallelujah. Thank you, Jesus.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
So my news is about Faith Ringgold. And I hope that our audience knows who she is. And if not, go seek her art. I don't remember the first time I saw a Faith. I don't remember the first time I saw her work, but I remember it was a quilt. So Faith Ringgold is known. She's an incredible artist. She's known most for her quilt work, but she also does sculpture and she is such a multifaceted artist. She does performance art. And her career really, I think, started to take shape during the Black Arts Movement. She was a part of the Black Arts Movement, which was such a beautiful time in terms of the work that produced. But the push for the Black artists, for the Black Arts Movement, was what was going on sort of at the tail end of the Civil Rights Movement. And, you know, sort of aligned and akin to what the Black Panther Party was ideologically saying in terms of Black self-determination, using voice and some, you know, and if it comes to it, violence for Black liberation. And so Faith Ringgold was very much a part of it. Others that were part of that movement, if folks aren't familiar, you know, Nika Giovanni, Audre Lorde, Amiri Baraka, Gwendolyn Brooks, and so many more. But part of why this came to light is in preparation for a show that's happening at the Chicago Exhibition that now I feel so compelled to go see. Faith Ringgold passed away over, I can't remember, it was some time over the weekend or late last week. First of all, this woman just, when you look at her, is just a light. It's just a being, like always, like sort of just a cultural reference, sort of like Erykah Badu before Erykah Badu. Okay. Like this woman was really, I think, setting the pace and the rhythm in terms of Black expression. And one of my favorite pieces of hers actually was like she was like, this is in a quilt, but it's like a time machine. And she goes back to France in, I think, the 1920s and has conversations with Picasso and others about the African influence in art. But it's done through the quilt in a very, takes you to the past, but almost sort of Afrocentric vibe feeling sort of way. She also was, so much a part of her practice was activism. And I think, you know, the Black Arts Movement artists, a lot of their practice was activism. And so she was a part of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War and actually spent some nights in jail because of, I think it was the burning of a flag or something like that that happened. She also has a quilted piece that is actually going to be a part of the Chicago exhibition, I think, that she did for the women of Rikers. So part of her journey and part of her practice was the liberation of women in particular. And so I think she felt this in a very particular sort of way when it came to incarcerated women. The list goes on and on in terms of like all of the activist work that she did, whether that was making sure that more women were able to show in some of these sort of bigger institutions. And so, yeah, I just feel like she is in so many parts, in so many ways, like a cornerstone of just American contemporary art and how she elevated it. She created expansiveness around it. She created inclusivity around it. And is such an incredible Black story, just storyteller. But when it comes to Black folk and Black culture, I just see Faith Ringgold as one of our most treasured storytellers. And so, yeah, I just wanted to bring this to the pod because she just is. Right. And I think she was born in 1939, I think, in Harlem. And, you know, the folks that were supposed to be her mentors and people we love, like Romare Bearden, were like, okay, girl, you're cute. But, and then she became who she became. So I just wanted to bring her presence and her light to y'all because I love y'all. And I just think she is such a treasure.
Thank you for bringing this podcast. I don't think that we could have avoided bringing Ms. Faith to the podcast because she's such a pioneer. I think one thing I'm extremely appreciative of, specifically as a few things I'm very appreciative of when I reflect on her. One being old age. You know, I am not one of those you know, do not do it. I'm not one of those people who cries over the casket when somebody leaves at 90, 92, 100, all these other things. So I also think about what type of connection to peace, to self-expression, to transmutation of trauma that you have to be a Black woman who was born in 1939 to be able to not get out from some type of stress-induced disease or organ failure. Like, that to me is like something that I have to like recognize. The other thing too is selfishly, maybe like partly narcissistically, when I see these artists, specifically these ones who are part of the Black Arts Movement, move in how they live their life, I kind of think about how limited those times were and how they found ways. You know, for the last couple of years, or few years, really, oh, goodness, the last few years, I've been, like, so big on, okay, I actually feel a white supremacist thing happening when people say, oh, you're a writer, and you care about reacting to white culture, or you care about this thing, because it really actually makes sure that I'd never in place in a generative space, and, I think her being a performance artist, her being a painter, her being having all these different modalities of how she expressed herself really denies this place of, oh, we'll put you in this little short closed mm-hmm. box, and this is where you are. I think that we can see a lot of people, I think like so many people come to mind, but like Baldwin really felt victim to always kind of being in a constant engagement with white culture and never being able to necessarily be imaginative or generative. And I just think that she's done that. And then also like the quilt, you know?
Yes.
Quilt. I think there's something to be said about, you know, being an esteemed Black woman artist and making the quilt, which is such a tradition in our culture, and making that your centerpiece. I think sometimes we can get so caught up, and I love it. Don't do not hate me. I love the Sugar Sphinxes. I love all these kind of avant-garde big works. But I think there's something really cool which you can come and show up in these institutions with what your grandma's grandma did. Mm. You don't have to do what the white people did or what you think is the most avant-garde thing or whatever. You did what your grandma's grandma people's did, and that's how you got into the museum. And I think there's something really beautiful about that. So thank you so much for being a light, and you know, my belief system, I think she could still hear us. So thank you so much for being a light to all artists in Black folks.
Yes, the quilt. I mean, I first encountered Faith Ringgold as a children's book author. I started my teaching career in 1992 in the South Bronx. And one of the things that we all taught, no matter what subject we were teaching, was a book called Tar Beach. And Tar Beach was a story about a little Black girl who lived in Harlem who wanted to be free and who wanted to fly. And Tar Beach, the title, is a reference to her rooftop in Harlem, right? When you don't have a beach, you make a beach. And Tar Beach was her rooftop in Harlem where she was able to transcend all of the things happening and fly all over the city. And so I encountered Faith Ringgold as the deliverer of freedom for little Black girls in New York City who could go to their rooftops and lay down on the top of their roof and be absolutely and totally free. And then realized that Tar Beach was the story of one of the quilts that she had, that she had designed. And so one, like, freedom is my thing. Black freedom for real is my thing. But then to be immersed into this world of quilts, which Miles, you so eloquently stated, like, this is our heritage, this is our history, this is our art on our terms, that she was able to put into the mainstream, that she was able to make relevant again, to take folk art, what our grandmothers did, and bring it to galleries and to the world is just astounding. So yes, Miss Faith, thank you, thank you, thank you. And keep on inspiring us. Yes, thank you.
I learned about who Faith Ringel was pretty recently. And of all places, I was doing a tour at Rikers and went to Rosie's, which is where the women are housed at Rosie's. And as soon as you walk into Rosie's, there's this beautiful piece of art. And, you know, Rikers is not a particularly beautiful place. So as I'm walking on Rikers, it's like, you know, if you've never been to a prison, they are all pretty drab and dark and there's not a lot to look at. But at Rosie's, there's like this really beautiful, huge piece of art that's encased in glass. So when I'm walking, I'm like, I asked, you know, at the warden, at the guy who ran the prison time, I'm like, you know, what is this? And he's like, oh, that's this piece by this artist named Faith Ringel. And I'm like, well, how, you know, it's at Rosie's. And they're like, yeah, it's been here for a long time. You know, she's an important artist, Black woman, da da da. So I go home and I look up Faith Ringel. And that was my first encounter with Faith Ringel, was actually seeing her piece of art at Rosie's, which is a women's facility at Rikers. And it was this really beautiful moment of being like, wow, people see this here. There's not a lot of beauty in this place at all, anywhere. Like, it's no color, it's no nothing. And there was Faith. And that was my introduction to her. So in hearing about her passing, it made me look up even more about her. You all have already covered it. But it was an honor to see one of her pieces in real life, and it has been there for a very long time. And I am happy that people get access to art.
Between Iran and Faith Ringel, the phrase that DeRay just said, "And there was Faith," sounds like a really pretty title for this episode.
Kai, it's you.
Well, there's not faith in the state of Tennessee, friends, because... sorry.
Get my Bible shell.
Because the state Senate just passed a bill in Tennessee that would allow teachers to carry concealed handguns at kindergarten through 12th grade schools. And I bring this to the pod maybe out of real incredulousness, because I pride myself on trying to like see other people's perspectives and to be empathetic and understanding. And there's just no world in which I can understand why we think it would be important to allow teachers in schools to carry concealed weapons. I just don't know. I cannot think of a use case for why this would be important, that our schools would be better, our kids would be better, teachers would be better, our communities would be better if teachers were packing, you know, concealed weapons. But in the state of Tennessee, a set of lawmakers thinks that this is really important. And even after there was a fatal shooting at a private Christian school in Nashville, where 3 9-year-olds and 3 adults were killed, they believe that it would be really important to allow teachers to carry concealed weapons. The bill still has a ways to go. It has to go through the House and then be approved by the governor. And, you know, there are all of these things that people have to do before they can get a permit to carry weapons in schools, I guess. But if you remember last year or so, there were 3 Black lawmakers in Tennessee who were expelled. And we remember their activism, we remember their expulsion and then their reinstatement. But the reason that they were all up in arms was because the legislature was proposing to allow teachers to carry guns in school. And so it seems that that piece continues. 34 states bar teachers and the general public from carrying guns in K-12 schools. We have safe school zones where if you commit a crime near a school, the penalties are increased. And somehow or another in the state of Tennessee, they feel like it is important to allow people to carry weapons. So I bring this to the pod because I am really perplexed about the solutions that people are coming up with. I don't even know what problem this is trying to solve, frankly. Like, I'm baffled. I read this and I literally don't know what to do with it. And so I brought it to the pot because maybe you smart people can help me understand why we think this is good. I can only imagine that at some point, somebody in a school, a teacher, an educator, an adult, will take out their concealed weapon and there will be tragedy that results from it. Not like we don't already have all kinds of tragedies happening in schools with guns, but only then will we say, do teachers really need to carry guns? I remember when Betsy DeVos was the Secretary of Education, and during her confirmation hearing, they asked her if it was important, like if she, they sort of challenged her and said, you support teachers carrying guns in school. And she said some ludicrous things like, well, what if a bear came to school and the teachers needed to defend kids from the bear? I don't know. I have been in and around schools for years and no bears ever came to school. Nobody ever needed to shoot a bear. Nobody. So explain this to me, friends. Help me make it make sense to me. Why would we arm teachers in schools where our precious, precious babies are? Why? Tennessee, what's going on?
Luckily, this has not been signed into law. It is still being a proposed bill. The proposed bill, though, there's a question of, will parents get notified? And they're like, no. And you're like,
no,
what?
No, that's right.
So not only will they let your teacher carry a concealed weapon, but you won't know. And I'm actually like, not only do I think that it will lead to something, you know, like, Lord knows, teacher is a really broad title. So that could be anybody in the school. You know, when people hear teacher, they think, I don't know, Miss Matthews, a first grade teacher. But depending on how you operationalize stuff, this could be, you know, any adult in the building that they label something. So that's even, you know, this is not necessarily like licensed teachers, whatever. It could be any adult who's in the building, first of all. But the second thing is, you know, even the best teachers, you cannot see 100% of what is happening around you all the time. This is how kids are on cell phones. When we were in school, we were passing notes behind a teacher's back. You know, now they text him behind a teacher's back. But it's kids. They always into something. What I think is going to happen is that the gun is locked up or not. The kid gets the key and is playing around or being nosy. It's not locked up. A kid gets a thing and is just playing around, and then tragedy ensues because it just is accessible. You talk about school shootings. Imagine what happens when the guns are just in the school. You know, like, part of what we do with kids is, kids have big feelings. Adults have big feelings, Lord knows, but kids definitely have big feelings. And we got to help people figure out how to manage those big feelings. That's a part of what we do in schools. And it is important that we don't have weapons around them when they're trying to process their big feelings, because they are big. They are like having tantrums and meltdowns. And what we're doing with them is timeouts and, you know, send them to the office so they can cool down. They make irrational choices in the midst of big feelings. And we know that. That's not a surprise. The idea of making guns, just putting them around kids, is just a recipe for disaster. And like Kaya said, what problem are we solving? We'll be back here if this passes when a tragedy ensues. Like, how did this happen?
This is such a weird, like only, it's just such an oddly like American thing to hear. Like, how do we address this? Oh, more guns. Like, it's so weird. The part that I thought was really interesting too was, just thinking about how it's been like very difficult to like pass gun laws and reform and all these different things. But inside this article, they have a list of things that the teachers need to get an enhancement carry permit, get written authorization from superintendent, principal, da da da, complete 40 hours of basic training in school policing and 40 hours of peace officer standards and training commissions, da 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 da, complete a background check, undergo a psychological exam conducted by a Tennessee licensed healthcare provider. I'm like, can we get that to the gun laws? don't give this to the teachers, but can we make this the what you need in order to even be able to touch a gun in this country?
That's right.
Because you know how to do it because you're doing it for the teachers. So yeah, this is just ridiculous. And I think I don't know how on purpose this is, whatever. But what I also think that this does is get people so hopeless around a peaceful America, because it seems as though all of the resolve and all of the solutions that are coming are so stupid. So I don't know a different term for it. And they're so anti-peace. And I think that's what that does for people, is make people not even want to engage with seeing a America with less guns and more peace, because these are the reactions to it. And I don't know if people are smart enough. I'm not talking about these lawmakers are smart enough to think that strategically, like, oh my goodness, we're going to weaponize our incompetence and say like, oh, we know what the answer to this is, more guns. So they leave us alone about the guns. But to me, that is something that ends up happening with stuff like this too, is that people just kind of want to, you know, just take their kids out of school and just give up, because what? It just boggles my mind that this is even, an option for people.
This is where my brain went with things like this. One, this has nothing to do with the children, obviously, and more to do with political agendas that support the gun lobby or that are pushed by the gun lobby. And so that was my first instinct when it came to this, because I would assume that there is a very powerful gun lobby in the state of Tennessee. But what my, where sort of the Googling and the research led me was actually to some darkness and controversy within education in Tennessee that's connected to this governor. So what I'm finding is that there's actually, and Dre and Kai obviously know more about this, but there's been a powerful charter lobby in Tennessee, and somehow the charters are connected to private investment groups that then can make money off of the chart. I don't know how this all works, but that's what I'm finding more and more of, that there's just actually some education policy related monies going in places they shouldn't be going, fraud type looking things. So I think this is even more complicated than what we thought it was, and that it could be interesting actually for us to get somebody from Tennessee that is politically savvy in that state to explain to us how something so wild like this has come to be. So it was nothing helpful here other than that this is actually deeper and darker than I think we know it to be, and that we probably should dig into it a little bit deeper with somebody that understands nuance like Tennessee politics.
Tiara, I will say you have just opened you've opened a box that we're not ready to dig into just yet. But I will say that, you know, you've heard the phrase politics make strange bedfellows. And I think that one of the challenges in the education community is that in pursuit of some educational innovation and policies, the education community has gotten into bed with people who in the rest of our lives, outside of our educational lives, who espouse different principles than what I believe. I won't say we. I will say that there are a lot of issues, for example, that are important to my non-education life that, where we can find commonality in the education space. And I think that we will get in bed with people who we have some common interests on education and not realize that while the left hand is doing this education stuff, the right hand is doing a whole bunch of other things. And I think that that is a reckoning that is happening in the education community now as we watch lawmakers and legislators who have been champions for some of the things that we appreciate in education also champion causes that are killing our communities. And so I think the education community is having a rough reckoning right now around some of these issues. That's my nice, clean, way in a bow. Yeah,
put a bow. Exactly. But that's so fascinating, though. Like, I wouldn't have thought, you know, just when you think sort of the root cause is a simple thing. It's not in this particular instance. And I think to your point, Kai, when we think about education, we think about one of those safe spaces that isn't necessarily going to have, you know, private interests that are somehow guiding and shaping some of its advocacy.
And let's go back to our history. Tennessee is one of the states that has had some of the most anti-Black, I mean, Tennessee kicked off post-Reconstruction, some of the Black codes, the Jim Crow, the really deeply entrenched policies that were anti-Black. And so, you know, we got to know these things so that we're not surprised. Like, it is not surprising to me that this is kicking off in Tennessee if you deeply understand American history. So go study history, people.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming. My news is about the state of Louisiana. You know, I've been dealing with Louisiana, unfortunately, for a while because of my own court case. But in the state of Louisiana, they implemented a look-back period for victims of sexual assault. So, as we know, many people who are sexually assaulted as kids and as adults, it takes some time for them to say the claims out loud. And most of the statutes of limitation around the country for sexual assault are really short. So, if you don't report it within 3 years or 5 years and you can't report it at all. There's some crimes like murder where there either is no statute of limitations or it is very, very long. But sexual assault is one that historically is not that long. And as a result, there are many states that have put together look back periods. So you all know this because this is how Diddy gets sued in the state of New York. Is that in New York, they put together a look-back period that said, if you file a claim within this set of years, even if it's a really old claim, you have a set of years in this look-back period to file a claim. And after this look-back period, we're closing it back up, and it's going to be the regular statute of limitations. So in Louisiana in the 70s, there was the Diocese of Lafayette in St. Martinville. They were sexually abusing a host of young boys in between ages 8 and 14. And they didn't disclose this until they were in their 50s and 60s. In 2021, the Louisiana legislature unanimously passed the Louisiana Child Victims Act, which provided a 3-year look-back window that allowed survivors to file lawsuits that would otherwise be barred by the statute of limitations. Now, that's the lead up. The news is that this got contested by the diocese, who does not want to be sued. And the Louisiana State Supreme Court, in a 4-3 decision, said that the church has a property claim to not be sued. And they essentially nullified the look back period that was set unanimously by the legislature. And it has confused a whole lot of legal experts because they're like, what is going on? But it is, the reason I bring it is that it's a stunning reminder of the way the system protects a whole host of people with structural power. And, you know, the church in a lot of places, like in Baltimore, there's a big lawsuit around the archdiocese, but these cases are popping up, and the church has been a massive enabler and perpetrator of sexual abuse to kids, and it has largely gone unpunished. And I bring this up just because this is the latest case. But these lawsuits are popping up all over the place. And the legal rigmarole that is happening to protect these priests and to protect the financial interests of the church is stunning to me.
I think this is like directly connected with what Auntie Kaya and Diara were talking about with the politics making strange bedfellows, and specifically times like this, you're able to see. I don't, you know, again, I, like probably like color me naive, but like, so I, when I think of a church, I still think of a church, you know, but there's these political, and obviously heinous acts that have happened, or maybe not obviously, allegedly heinous acts that have happened, but then, but there's like this like political bonding that is, that's happening and protection that's happening that you're just like, why do you need that? I think what makes me most sad about this story, I guess the emotion is sad, is the fact that this is supposed to be some place where, like, I don't, like, y'all, we just, there's a lot of need for some faith. There's a lot of need for some type of moral center, you know, for a lot of people. A lot of need for people to be able to feel like they can go somewhere and feel safe. And even if this happened years and years ago, if something happened years and years ago, it's really important for an institution to do something now. And for it to instead bar victims from getting justice, like that to me just says something a lot about what the church is actually being used for, you know? It's being used for political navigation. It's being used for profit and taxes and no taxes and stuff, but it seems like it's not being used for a whole lot of doing anything in alignment with what we will call God or a Messiah, which I think just feels really, just really, really sad. Is there, I guess I have a question for Diara and or DeRay. Is there any type of like, is the term like an appeal? Like, is there anything that like those people can do?
I'm looking through now just to see where they are in the appellate process. The other thing we need to realize about Louisiana, the legal system there is also like a little bit different than everywhere else. So
a little bit different.
They have a completely different legal system. So the rest of our country is a common law system that we got from the British, but Louisiana still sort of, it's like a French system. It's a civil law system. And so it's a lot different in terms of like, even how it's set up adversarially. So, so all that to say, we need a lot of experts today. I'm not an expert on Louisiana, legal system, but what I will say and what I think is compelling to me about this and something I thought about since I applied to law school is that, you know, our, in this country, you know, laws and from the Western people, we've gotten these laws that have been set up, and really so much at the heart of these legal systems is the protection of property, right? It's little about the protection of rights, whether it's free speech or your right to religion, yada, yada, yada. Like, it really comes down to the importance of how we're protecting white people's, white men's property and money.
Say it.
And so I think this, and it's actually the judge in Chief Justice John Waymer. This is how, in his dissent, he says, essentially, you're elevating vested property rights, which are purely economic rights, above all other rights, including such fundamental rights as the rights to privacy, to free speech, and to freedom of religion and from racial discrimination. So I think that's sort of my point, right? Is that when it comes down to the balance of the monies versus the people, the monies is going to be the thing that is given greater significance. So I think that's sort of the takeaway here from my legal perspective.
I'm not a legal expert, but I've been a human my whole entire life. And that more people thought that it was okay to preserve the pedophile priest's right to economic justice through property, as opposed to these people's right to seek justice for, you know, what happened to them is incredulous to me. It really is. I don't have much else to say on this. But I do think that we often underestimate, you know, Miles, you talked about a church being a church and a safe place for people to go. I think we have to also recognize that these are institutions with powerful monetary interests, lobbying abilities, and that will protect these economic and power dynamics at all costs. And I think that's what you see happening here in Louisiana. Absolutely. I love Louisiana as a place to visit. Place to visit, child. But woo.
But I'll tell you this, and this is something that I've been thinking about, is that, first of all, I love the South and I refuse to lose it. Okay. And I feel like Georgia in particular is a good example of what can happen in a Southern state politically, right? The fact that it's now a battleground state, the fact that Stacey Abrams was a gubernatorial candidate, like those things can happen in other places in the South. I do deeply, getting back to our faith, I think that they can. So basically, I just want to make an announcement. Y'all's days is number, because we's going to take that too. Okay.
Yes.
With my news, I'm kind of double dutching because we've had two interesting men who don't really have any overlap. I don't want to make it seem like I'm like, I'm creating some them as equals, but it, we had two black men who passed away. One being Mr. C. Mr. C is an accomplished, iconic DJ in New York. Was just part of breaking so many New York City records. Everybody has a Mr. C story, who's of a certain era, who's in the industry. I was loving seeing everybody who I knew, well, a lot of people I know in media or in music, talk about how iconic Mr. C was. And also, I mean, I didn't see everybody talking about this, but also, you know, walk with me. Once upon a time, I was a avid Wendy Williams fan. Even in the state, even in the city of Atlanta, I was an avid Wendy Williams fan. And I would go on radio.com and figure out what she was saying. And Mr. C was somebody who Wendy Williams always talked about. She would always talk about his sexuality. She would always accuse him of being queer and gay and all these different things. And Mr. C was arrested a few times for being for picking up trans sex workers. So when Mr. C had passed away, I was really interested in if he's ever addressed those things specifically before he died, because, you know, I was just kind of in my head wondering what happened with those rumors and what happened with those accusations and stuff. And I was really happy, quite frankly, to find this video that he did with Maino, and just trigger warning, if you're going to search for this video that I'm telling you about, trigger warning, they are not having the most respectable and or academic discussion of gender and sexuality that you can have. It is a lot of Brooklyn Negro talk, but nevertheless, it was talks. So anywho, when Maino asked him about your attraction to trans women and do you like trans women and stuff like that, Maino did not use that language. But you love trans women. I was so happy to hear Mr. C said, "That's what I like." And I was so happy to hear Mr. C say, that's what I'm into. That's what I like. And I think that it takes such bravery for a Black man to be able to say that. So, yeah, I wanted to obviously talk about his career when it comes to music, when it comes to media, when it comes to what he's contributed to hip hop culture, because it's so big. But also, I think there's something happening in hip hop in general around queerness, around trans inclusivity, around sexuality that is both subversive, but also you get this really huge pushback of patriarchal and homophobic and transphobic forces that are always at tension. And I think that I do think that we should also remember Mr. C as somebody who eventually is one pegging, like normalizing people having diverse sexualities and genders inside of hip hop culture, because for whatever reason, hip hop people see hip hop as a place that is immune for that, even though once you crack that open, or once you are on the inside of hip hop culture, you see that there are so many homosexuals, so many people who are attracted to people who are not cis on the hip hop scene. One day I'll write my Corinne Steffens tell all book about the time about the men who have hollered at me. At me in all sizes and all amounts of concealer on and all types of blush.
Why one day? Why not today?
I have, because I want to get through my Faith Riggle era before I go totally trash box. So, you know, it's easier to go from that to trash than from trash to that. So there's a journey. Just ride it with me, friends. But but yeah, I wanted to bring that to the podcast too. So now flipping the page to another Black man who has passed away. One, O.J. Simpson passed away, and that is wild. My partner told me that O.J. Simpson passed away, and he was like, O.J. just died, and I was like, you know. He was riding here for quite a long time for somebody who killed somebody. I don't know what you want from me.
Two people.
Yeah, sorry. That's the exact. My boyfriend actually corrected me with the exact same language. Said two people, and I was like, oh, sorry, I forgot. I didn't know. I only know about that. Okay, but OJ's interesting, and I do feel like I wanted to bring this to the podcast because I do think that it highlights an end of an era. And I also think that when we think about, because I know about OJ in reverse, right? So Toni Morrison's book, it's such a weird long title. If somebody can look it up for me while I do, but it's Toni Morrison, Racing,
politics and gendering something, that one.
Yes. Yeah, where she talks about OJ, and there's a collection of other academics who are discussing OJ. I know about it through that and all the other content that I've seen. Yeah.
Racing, justice, and gendering power. That one.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. And she talks about. OJ
and Anita Hill
and all these other different things, and then I see comedy stand up acts that discuss OJ, and then of course it's just something that's in the air. Even watching Barbershop, and I remember Cedric Entertainer's kind of like bomb, like, well, not, it was a great joke, but that kind of joke that kind of ripples when people think about Barbershop is that he's in the barbershop saying OJ did it, and everybody's like, oh, that was like the big thing in Barbershop. So it's interesting because I think that from what I've seen is that OJ for a lot of people was a symbol that, oh wow, we might really be moving in this nation, because now a Black person is able to do something just as heinous as a white person and got away with it. And this shows a type of marker towards justice. Not saying that it was a universally Black thing to do, but I think that that is a dimension of what happened that I find the most interesting about OJ. I think a lot of people sincerely might have been questioning the system and saw people being framed before. I think Johnny Cochran was a masterful lawyer, a masterful speaker, and I think that he really knew how to storytell and use what was happening post Rodney King in order to really shape public dialogue and imagination around this. And the last thing I'll say is that it was again, I think because I just grew, I just was, the American culture is just the air for me. So there's, so it's weird to think that there's the, it's the, it's, there was a beginning. So it's almost like thinking of the first drop of water and if you're living in the Pacific Ocean. But he, but OJ was the first drop of water when it comes to court TV, when it comes to people talking about when these documentaries that we're watching, like he was the first when it comes to that. So I think although obviously he was not a good person by any stretch of the imagination, I do think culturally what his heinous acts did shaped America for forever, for the worse, but for the better or for the worse, but it shaped America forever. I think we can't say when we turn on our television, how we engage on social media, what we care about, what we sensationalize, what we do, the fact that we just spent all last year watching Gwyneth Paltrow and Johnny Depp in court, like all that is an echo of OJ. And I wanted to just recognize that culturally and bring that to the podcast with y'all, Mr. C and OJ.
There are two things that come to mind when I think about the OJ thing. One is, I don't know if you saw on Twitter, but somebody tweeted that now that he is dead, she can finally, won't be in violation of her NDA, is that she worked at the university that OJ went to, and he had, there are all these allegations of him sexually assaulting white women, and she was there when Robert Kardashian came to pay off the two women, and she had to process it. She was like, I took the check. She was like, my boss was the dean or whoever. She was like, I knew it, but I had to sign an NDA because I was a part of the process and I couldn't talk about it until he died. And she was like, he's finally dead. And she was like, this is why I've always hated the Kardashians. And she was like, there was always a pattern, but nobody could talk about it because we were bound by these NDAs. So that was interesting. And the second thing is that, and like Miles said, you know, it was in many ways the birth of the 24-hour news cycle. There were some reporters from that time talking. Somebody who was a reporter then was asked, like, why didn't you cover this day today? And he was like, well, the news was the trial and sort of the evidence. But he was like, from the moment it happened and all of that through the trial, he was like, this was every single day people were producing stuff about OJ. And that was sort of the first, and he was like, it was so confusing to me. But it is true that that this was one of the first cases that enthralled everybody in a very particular way. So, wild that it is, you know, that he has passed, and you know, culture happens every day.
Doris says, sorry to that man.
Sorry to that man.
All of this is so interesting, Miles.
I know, yeah, I gave y'all a wow, I gave y'all a double dutch.
Listen, so first of all, I mean, I am a product of both of these, like, of the, like, the heydays of both of these men, right? Like, and so on the Mr. C front, had knew who Mr. C was, knew about all his DJ and stuff, had no idea about his sexuality. And I think you brought up a really, really important point about hip hop's reckoning with who people really are. Right. And creating space for people in a genre that is wildly narrowing to live into its full expansiveness, right? Like, there are all kinds of people with all, doing all kinds of things in hip hop, but we have relegated a very narrow set of attributes and values and whatnot to hip hop. And I think it's falling apart. And so I actually think this is a good thing. And then the OJ thing is, like, you know, some of y'all probably were not born, but like, I know, I can tell you exactly where I was when the Bronco chase was happening, right? I remember watching it on TV. I was living in Brooklyn, in Clinton Hill. I was a teacher. I was standing in my apartment that evening having dinner, sitting in my apartment having dinner, when breaking news came on and we're all watching a white Bronco, you know, drive slowly through the freeways of LA with OJ Simpson in it. And, you know, from growing up as a little girl with OJ as a hero, right? OJ as the football star, the black man made good, the, all of these things, to the trial of the century. And, you know, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. And I mean, I still don't think that I have fully processed all of the various feelings and ideas that I have about the O.J. Simpson case. It is a cultural moment. O.J. ushered us into a different cultural moment, not just in terms of court coverage and media cases, but how we think about domestic violence in the world changed radically. Mm-hmm. And I can also remember exactly where I was the moment that the acquittal came through, because as one of a very few Black people in a white organization, I was at work, and you know, we were all in one room. Everybody in my organization was all in one room watching this on television. And I remember palpably when OJ got off, all of the people of color in the organization erupting in glee and, you know, celebration, and all of the white people, you know, not. And in some cases, it had nothing to do with domestic violence or Nicole and Ron. It had everything to do with Black and white in America. And so it is complicated and, you know, and yeah, still processing.
Mm-hmm. I think the same, Kai. I remember too, I was in high school. And I went to Murray, a very private white school in D.C. It's becoming less that our numbers are doing better and better. But all the high school kids watched around the TV, which is wild. And that's exactly what happened.
Crazy.
All the Black kids were thrilled and all. It was something. And to your point, Kai, it had very little to do with like.
The
individuals. Yeah. It was this very like visceral race related energy that I think we're just as Americans just operating in these energetic planes or fields or whatever. And some of these things are just so, so deeply in our molecules that this is, yeah, because, and I think, and I think it goes in a small piece of that too, I think within Black culture is just, and I think this is goes to the Puff Daddy thing too, where it was just like, we got to support each other. We got to support each other no matter, because O.J. Simpson wasn't even like riding for Black people at all.
Exactly.
Really.
Exactly.
You know, so it just, it was, it is so complicated. But I do have a funny O.J. story, because O.J. Simpson hangs out in Minnesota. You know where my family's from, y'all. And so
what? Why?
Because there's a golf course. There's actually a golf course up by where my grandparents had like a little lake house. Like a little lake house, y'all. My grandparents were blue collar workers. So in this town that we've been going to for decades has now become a pretty affluent town because of this golf course. And my mom, there's like a pizza shop there. My mom was there with some of my cousins. And O.J. Simpson walks in. And the white people are high-fiving him and so excited to see him. My mom, there's a killer in here. Okay. Girl, well, you're next. Okay?
Whoa.
You're next.
Whoa.
You're next.
She said he
turned around. My cousins had like deer in headlights. They had to, my cousin, we had to get your mom out of there because she was about to really go off. There's a killer in here. So
that is a great story. Listen, I'm like, our producer is going to have a field day with what to name this, because that might be a good one too. There's a killer in here. That is a good OJ story. Yeah, you need to. She needs to go speak at the funeral, or you need to tell that story.
I just was like, what is Lord. So
goodness.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Bossy and the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Bossy and the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Bossy and the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Finding a hoodie that lasts through the season can be tough. The American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last year after year. Snag the hoodie that brings comfort for life. Save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20 at checkout.